Hello and welcome to DNA, Design and Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. Some people call it the aughts, others the noughties. We may not have settled on a name, but it's been quite a decade. From 9/11 to Iraq and Afghanistan, from Katrina to Obama, Hummers to hybrids, and from bust to boom and back again. It's also been a time in which design and architecture has been in the spotlight. So on today's show, we'll look back and forward at design and architecture in LA and beyond. Coming up, we'll hear about Los Angeles' coming of age as a creative economy and why the ugliest structure in town makes the cut of the best buildings of the decade. But first, a look at the products and inventions that have defined the era and what they say about us. Dan Neal is the Pulitzer Prize-winning auto critic for the Los Angeles Times, who now holds forth on advertising and pretty much anything else that inspires his fast and fearless pen. I asked him for his choice of an era-defining piece of design.
Most people would say, you know, the development of Twitter and the social media. I tend to think it's the Dyson fan.
Not the vacuum.
The vacuum is actually a pretty terrible product. It doesn't work very well, and frankly, it looks kind of ugly. But the Dyson fan, this cat Dyson has been trying to revolutionize ordinary household items. Well, there's a reason, a logic, an inevitability about the way household items have evolved. This Dyson fan, what they call the air multiplier, I think it's just a dramatic breakthrough in the way we conceive of moving air around a room. It's a loop on a pedestal, and the air comes out of this very thin airfoil, the circumferential airfoil, and it is blown across the surface, the inner diameter of this loop, and the air comes tumbling out. It uses what is actually the turbulence of a wing form to create this air blast with no moving parts that you can see, right? There's no spinning fan blades or anything. And I think taking a very common item like that and then turning it inside out and doing something revolutionarily different, you got to give this Dyson guy some credit.
Huh. Now, I will just put in a little qualifier, which is that both I and Ray Guana, who is the co-producer and engineer of this program, we both have Dyson vacuum cleaners and we both love them. But we won't, dispute over the vacuums, I just want to say.
I think we need a, if you pardon the expression, well, no, I can't say it, but a vacuum off is what I was going to, what I was not going to say.
Well, Dyson, who actually comes from the same town that I grew up in, and when I was a 14-year-old working in a clothing store, he would come and test his prototypes in that very clothing store. So there's a sort of little bit of a personal connection there. But Dyson, what Dyson has done that's so interesting this decade is he has reinvented several wheels, reinvented the vacuum. Now you're saying reinvented the fan. What about the completely new inventions, like, say, the iPhone, the hybrid car? What of the new inventions would you single out?
Well, you mentioned the hybrid car, and I have to make a bid for the Toyota Prius. And the only caveat is that the Prius actually Toyota began to spend money on it and intellectual property in 1992, and that's how long it took for a major automotive company with the best minds in the business to execute what we now know as the Toyota Prius, which is really a remarkable automobile. When you look at what it does, it gets 50 miles per gallon. It moves five people. It produces, in the European test cycle, 89 grams of carbon per kilometer, which is so unbelievably low that even electric cars can't match it if you take into account the emissions from the power plants. This is an extraordinary breakthrough. And while some inventions are flashes of sort of Edisonian insight, the Toyota Prius was just – Toyota just ground it out day after day, year after year, just the accretion of some tremendous engineering insights. And it still is impossible to beat. It really is probably the top – in my top five cars of all time in terms of how radically it reimagined personal mobility.
Let's move on from cars and discuss networking and smartphones and, of course, the iPhone.
Well, in terms of design, the tactility, the manipulation of the iPhone, its weight, it also has a kind of inevitability. The radiuses and weight and size and the palmness, if you will, of the iPhone is truly perfect. And it did change people's lives. I know people, they're younger than I am, but they have developed, I think, you know, an iPhone callus in one hand. It's very compelling. It's very addictive. It truly has become sort of a psychic adjunct. I still think that there's work to be done yet on the iPhone design, though. For one thing, it's hard, you know, and I think the next interface that people will use will be soft, virtual. I imagine a projection of some kind into thin air that you can sort of manipulate without having the device, you know, holding the device in your hand. But for now, I think the iPhone really is an iconic designed item for the naughties.
This theme of projection seems to be very much part of our time. It seems that all around us is screens, whether it's the tiny screen of the iPhone or the super vast screen of the TV. What about this sort of omnipresence of screens?
Yeah, it's funny. I don't think we can make up our minds as consumers whether we want super high definition 60-inch plasma flat screens or whether we want to watch Seinfeld reruns on our iPhone. Why would people spend $6,000 on a television and then watch some YouTube video that looks like it was shot through an ice cube?
But why do we need all these screens? Are we going to at some point decide we're just going to look at each other rather than looking at a screen?
No, you know what it is? We're afraid we're going to miss something. Let's coin a phrase. It's invidious watching. And what it means is if you don't see something first or in the first wave of people who are aware of something, you feel behind. You feel awkward. You feel backward. And I think that we've somehow locked ourselves into this race to be first in knowledge.
We've been discussing the noughties. What is the next decade going to be called? Is it the teensies? What are the trends for the teensies or whatever's coming up around the corner?
Oh, you know, that's not bad, Francis. And here's why. Let's call them the teensies. and because everything is going to get smaller.
Except your TV screen.
Except your TV screen and, you know, if you're American, your waist. And I think we've embarked on a radical program of downsizing in the U.S. because really it's the end of the post-World War II ride. You know, we had an expansionist economy. We had a philosophy that free markets would sort themselves out, which is it's a faith-based purely on the notion that markets will get ever bigger and that people in markets will act, as the book says, rationally. But we've seen that that's not always the case. Now we're butting up against some very, very hard physical realities, one of which is the declining supply of cheap energy. Another is global warming. Food shortages are going to become more pronounced. You know, it's going to be a much more crowded planet physically and I think emotionally. And I think teensies is great because we really, this is going to be life de minimis. And you know what? I think it's good for, of all things, books. I think you're going to see a lot more people retreating into literature. Maybe they'll read it on Kindle, but honestly, I'm not sold on Kindle yet.
Why not?
Well, I just don't think the interface is very pleasing. In any event, I think people will be retreating back into literature in a way that probably they haven't in a long time. I think they'll be reawakened to the simple pleasures of a good book.
Well, Dan Neal, as usual, it's so good to talk to you. Thank you for giving me your time today.
Oh, you're very welcome, Francis. Love the show. Nice to talk to you.
Dan Neal is advertising and automotive columnist for the Los Angeles Times. And speaking of taking refuge in books, later in the show I'll talk with Fast Company's Alyssa Walker about some design and architecture books that may have captured the zeitgeist. You're listening to DNA on 89.9 KCRW and kcrw.com. I'm Frances Anderton. And now, the best buildings in LA of the last decade. For a long time, Los Angeles made its mark with experimental single-family houses. But the last decade has seen an explosion of civic buildings, police stations, libraries and schools, arts buildings, as well as some really interesting housing, like the cutting-edge condos and affordable apartment buildings in West Hollywood and Santa Monica. The real estate website Curbed LA decided to poll people on their favorite buildings of the decade within the city of Los Angeles. Here's Curbed LA's editor, Dakota Smith.
Well, you know, we probably emailed and talked to about 40 different people, and right away, three or four different buildings immediately stood out. There's the Gary Building.
Disney Concert Hall.
There's Caltrans, Tom Baines Building downtown. And so, like, immediately three or four stuck out at us. But, I mean, I think what's important about the list is that it's not necessarily a list that's based on great design. We have buildings on the list that are actually pretty ugly. But what we did is we looked at sort of what were the buildings that really had an impact from a cultural point of view, from a political point of view, or, you know, worked as a catalyst in terms of development.
Okay, well, let's start. You've got cultural, political development, impact on development. So what about cultural?
I would say looking back at something like the Getty Villa, it's a building people take for granted, and they don't necessarily know that, you know, there was lawsuits filed, that neighborhoods fought it, that it all came down to a city council vote. And without the sort of push to open it, we would never have it. And now it's sort of one of the really sweetest and nicest places to visit off the Pacific Coast Highway.
And we should say that the Getty Villa underwent a long and highly sort of conceptual renovation, didn't it?
Right. And now there's, like, you can listen to music there. It sort of has enriched the whole neighborhood. Another thing that we really wanted to do, which I don't think you would always find on a list, is we wanted to include as many neighborhoods as possible. So, you know, we looked at the Valley, and honestly, it was just hell to find something that we could include in the Valley. And I spent a lot of time with the op-ed editor of the Daily News looking at different buildings that have gone up in the last 10 years in the Valley. And we really struggled. And in the end, we picked a really sweet, beautiful building, the Van Nuys Civic Hall, which was restored in 2005. And from a political point of view, that building was really meant to give a bit more of a voice to the Valley. Now, once a month, the city council has its meetings there.
So some sort of aesthetic quality you were looking for, because you say there's some ugly buildings on the list. Pick out your ugliest.
Well, we picked like probably the worst building in all of Los Angeles, which is Hollywood and Highland. But, you know, what happened is that if you look at Hollywood development right now, there's so many great things that have happened. There's the Palladium renovation. There's Tom Main's plans for this Emerson College building. And there's just been a resurgence of Hollywood development. So when
The new W Hotel.
So much going up. And I called up a lot of different business people in Hollywood. And I said, well, what was the catalyst? What was the one building that started all of this? And they all said it was Hollywood and Highland, which brought back the Oscars right after 9/11 to Hollywood. Also in Hollywood, we picked the ArcLight, which was another building that sort of helped bring in more development to Hollywood. That also changed movie going a bit in Los Angeles too.
In what way?
I think it sort of raised the bar. You go there, you can have a glass of wine, you have these amazing seats. The technology is so good. I mean, the movie going experience of my childhood was like hard, uncomfortable chairs, dusty, you know, bad popcorn. And now it's really sort of it's elevated, and it's almost it's very sophisticated movie going now because of that.
Is the popcorn better at ArcLight?
I don't know about the popcorn, but I know they have like fancy sandwiches, and
they have to do something to get people into the cinema, given the 56-inch TV screen is the competition.
Exactly.
Now, several of your best buildings are remodels, which is pretty interesting.
Well, that was surprising given the real estate boom and the building boom that's gone on, particularly in California, Nevada, Florida. You think about how much construction's gone on. But when we looked at the new buildings, whenever there was a renovation of a building that was suggested, we really felt like we had to include it because it was such an important LA building, something like the Griffith Observatory or the Getty Villa, or in the case of downtown, we picked the Standard Hotel, which Andre Balaz renovated and opened up as a boutique hotel. And that building was one of the first buildings to come and sort of bring people downtown and make sort of a kickstart the downtown, I guess, hip scene that you see now.
There's a lot of people out in the development world, architecture world, that are anxious at the moment because things have been so slow for a while. Based on all that you've observed and received in terms of information, where would you say the trends are pointing for the next decade?
In terms of development, it's so grim, I would say. I had dinner with about six other developers last week, and they all talked about how difficult it was to get a construction loan. There's no construction loans being given out right now. I don't think anyone is going to be building anything major, at least for another year or so. There'll be smaller projects going up, and there'll be some sort of creative ways to get financing. But it's going to be slow for a while. And then in terms of trends, when I talk to developers, they talk about affordable housing, and they talk about hotels and office, and those three arenas we'll probably see some, you'll see development on that front. But in terms of housing and for, you know, competitive condo rate housing, I don't think there's going to be a lot of new condo buildings built anytime soon.
That's a pity, because there was definitely some really interesting work going there.
There was.
Well, Dakota Smith, it's been so interesting hearing how people read the best buildings in Los Angeles.
Thank you, Frances. Thank you for having me.
Dakota Smith is the editor of Curbed LA, a website, a real estate-oriented website that asks designers and critics to choose their best buildings of the aughts. For the complete lists of best buildings and runners-up, go to the link on our website. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA on 89.9 KCRW and kcrw.com. For many designers and architects in LA, the last year or two has been an extreme challenge. But if they can get through the next year or so, designers will find themselves busy again, even as the region's manufacturing base continues to decline. That's according to the Otis College of Art and Design's 2009 report on the creative economy. The report, now in its third year, tracks the ups, downs, and importance to the region of LA's creative industries that include fashion and toys, architecture and animation. Sammy Hoy is president of Otis, and he explained the evolution of LA's creative economy and where it's going.
If we look back at the last three decades, you see a gradual progression of Los Angeles' creative economy and design industries coming out of the shadow of the film industry. For example, in the 80s, most people would probably still think of Los Angeles as Hollywood, as movie town. But in the 90s, the surfwear and sportswear fashion trend has re-infiltrated all our wardrobe practices. So when people thought of Los Angeles, they began to think of Los Angeles as a lifestyle town. Now, in the turn of the century, between the opening of the Getty Center in Brentwood and also the opening of Disney Hall downtown, we cannot underemphasize the iconic power of Disney Hall. When that opened, suddenly you see overnight all the international press basically saying Los Angeles has arrived and Los Angeles is the new cultural capital. And then around the same time, it was also when the concept of creative economy became a worldwide concept of how our economy has really finally moved from a kind of industrial age into an idea age. Los Angeles is, to my view, the most futuristic of American cities, given our urban landscape, the sprawling landscape that we have, the very fertile mixture of populations and cultures. So if there's any kind of prime beta market that look at how cultures get hybridized and how good design can appeal to across segments of the public, this is it. So I think that actually more companies will be possibly moving into Los Angeles because that's where the future market will be.
Now, it's very interesting. You single out LA as being possibly one of the most creative or forward-looking cities in America. Is it one of the most forward-looking in the world? I mean, I do remember being in LA. I moved here 20 years ago. And in the course of the first 10 years, one definitely felt that LA was perceived around the world as a really, really interesting creative city. Over the last 10 years, it feels as if the energy has perhaps slightly shifted. How do you think LA stands globally?
That's a really intriguing question. I think LA still has the potential to lead in art and design in the world. But I agree with you, its energy has been somewhat overtaken by some other cities in the world, not because of the lack of infrastructure or talents here, but I think the creative economy and the importance of the caring and feeding of creative resources here in Los Angeles have not been supported yet by public policy. So I think there's tremendous potential, and LA will always be an incredibly innovative and creative city, but it will take some coming together of legislatures, educators, community leaders, a rally around the creative economy in order for it to claim its top spot in the world as a creative and design capital, which it totally deserves to be.
Well, Samuel Hoy, thank you so much for talking to me.
Oh, thank you so much for this, for talking to me too.
Sammy Hoy is president of Otis College of Art and Design, and it produced the 2009 Otis Report on the Creative Economy in collaboration with the Los Angeles Economic Development Corporation. To read it in detail, go to the link on our website. One of the industries that's taken a big hit this decade is print publishing. The latest casualty is the venerable design magazine ID that closed last week. But there's still a place for the beautifully designed or written book. To conclude this show, I asked Alyssa Walker to share her picks of new books that may have somehow captured the zeitgeist. Alyssa is no mean writer herself. She's a design editor for Fast Company, a contributor to Good, and associate producer of DNA. Alyssa, hi, and what do you have for us?
The first book that I have come across was a very important book that was published earlier this year by a guest that you've had on the show, Jeff Mano, and it's called The Building Blog Book. He had a very popular blog for many years. Building Blog still has it. And he's published a book that includes a lot of the essays that were published on the blog over the years, and also kind of expands them with these wonderful illustrations and photographs, kind of looking at a futuristic examination of architecture. So that for the Wired fan in your life, or the tech guru, someone who's really interested in how cities work, that's a great book to pick out.
And he's a true ruminator,
yes,
isn't he, Jeff? He just thinks about things in the most deep and interesting way, and is a marvelous writer. So what comes up next?
Well, we have another young writer, Emily Pilloton. And so what she's done is collected what's called the Design Revolution, 100 products that empower people. Some are very high tech and some are very low tech, but each of them, she says, are helping the world in a different way. And it's a beautiful book for someone who cares a lot about the socially responsible design movement that's been popping up in the last few years. This is the best introduction to it, and it features a lot of things that you are very familiar with in your everyday life.
Since we are on the topic of socially responsible design, I think I should mention that a book that I have on my list, which is just out, is a publication of a book called Architecture in Times of Need, Make It Right, Rebuilding New Orleans, Lower Ninth Ward. And this is a book that tracks really the start of this amazing project co-created by movie star Brad Pitt, together with the architecture firm Graft and McDonough and Partners and Cherokee Gives Back, start in 2007. This was a reaction to what we, I think, would all agree is one of the most devastating events of the last decade, which was Katrina. And Brad Pitt, being enormously interested in design himself, assembled this team of people who are essentially creating affordable, sustainable houses for people who were utterly devastated in the Lower Ninth Ward that are also tremendously interesting architecturally. So if you want that convergence of social justice and architectural edge, this book will be really, really interesting to you. So anyway, Alyssa, back to you.
Another kind of interesting, maybe some trend, more of the coffee table books that you want to put out for everyone to see. One of them is Dark Nostalgia, which was written by the writer Eva Hagberg. And this traces the trend that we've seen everywhere, if you stop and think about it, especially at a lot of restaurants and bars and hotels here in LA. That dark leather, that taxidermy, curious objects in these like little, you know, glass cabinets that kind of pique your interest. And she's just compiled a wonderful a wonderful view of all these different projects, but also kind of why we're looking for that at this time in our lives. We're kind of overwhelmed with technology, and we want to look to the familiar, but slightly skewed, slightly a witty take that we weren't expecting the first time around. You know, this kind of like steampunk aesthetic that we're embracing, places like the Edison here in town.
And the basements.
Yeah, in the basements, Prohibition style.
That is a good choice. Well, speaking of Prohibition style, you've brought me on to just quickly mention a book among my stack. I can actually pick it up. Los Angeles, Portrait of a City, edited by Jim Hyman, with essays by Kevin Starr and David Ulin, published by Taschen Books, who haven't given up on doing their very weighty coffee table books. I bring it up at this point in the conversation because Alyssa mentioned Prohibition. This book is an incredible photographic history of LA, dating right back to the late 1800s, but encompassing the era of gangsters and Prohibition. And there are some photos that will just make your eyes pop out. Back to you, Alyssa.
Yeah, I've got one that is kind of related to that. The book Living West, which was written by Sam Lubell, who is the editor of the Architect's Newspaper. He's the California editor. And this is, again, one of those beautiful coffee table books that makes you appreciate why you live in L.A. or why you live on the West Coast. But it's a series of very new homes. I think they were all completed since 2000, I believe. They've been completed in the last 10 years. And it's just super contemporary architecture by the region's most fantastic architects.
Speaking of which, I'll just jump to a book that I have in front of me, which also deals with a residence. And it's possibly America's most famous residence.
That's
right. It's not in Los Angeles. It's the White House. It's called here the Dream House, The White House as an American Home, by Ulysses Grant Dietz and Sam Watson. And given the momentous election of last year, the White House takes on, I suppose, new meaning. But this book is really interesting because it tracks the evolution of the White House as a house, as a home. To sum it up, the White House has morphed, they say, from a country house to a suburban home to a museum. And they track that evolution again, as with the Los Angeles book by Taschen, with some really surprising and fascinating photographs, not to mention what they actually have to say about it. So if you're interested in the White House sociologically, architecturally, and from an interior design perspective, this is the book for you. Alyssa, back to you.
Well, that's actually all that I have from other people, but I do have a book that I wrote. It's actually not a book. It's a deck of cards called City Walks Architecture New York. And you don't have to look like a tourist with this gigantic travel book. You can kind of like very surreptitiously pull the card out of your pocket and just peek to where you're going. Hopefully I'll be doing LA in the near future.
And Alyssa, you're going to start walking back to Silver Lake after
right,
we finish this interview?
I'll be.
Well, Alyssa, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
For a full list of the books we discussed, as well as many others we couldn't fit onto the show, go to our website. And in case you too have a taste for the dark nostalgia that Alyssa talked about, I want to draw your attention to a must-see show. The design collector and dealer Joel Chen has a looming loft at 941 North Highland, in which he's currently showing Porcelain Jewelry by Patrick Muff and Skull-like Soul Catchers by Michelle O'Cadonna, in an installation that looks like it was dreamed up in a back room in Edgar Allan Poe's mind. It's on through the end of January with a break for the holiday. That's it for today's DNA, the last one of the noughties or the aughts. Thanks very much for listening. DNA is produced by Ray Guana with production assistance from Alyssa Walker. The consulting producer is Jennifer Farrow. Thanks as always to Nan Sherry Lieberman for managing the website. You can podcast DNA, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with the click of a button from our new media player at kcrw.com. Or you can get it from iTunes. I'm Frances Anderton. Please have a very happy holiday and join me next year for more DNA.